Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm here to connect the dots between our personal health and everything we need for that and our total health environment, the health of our communities, the health of our food, our water, our neighborhoods, our society, and, of course, the health of planet Earth. All of these things are connected and part of what we all need for personal health. Every week on this show, I bring you different guests and experts and wise people who specialize in different areas of health, all the way from the inner psychic to the biological to the societal and to the global and the ecological. And each week we talk about a different facet of what creates health in our total health environment and connect the dots. This show also features a great deal of activism because it's important. As someone who's reported on integrative medicine and been a practitioner for over 20 years, actually, it's really important to both take care of your personal health through making healthy food choices, avoiding toxins, dealing with your inner psychological issues, improving relationships, and it's also important to take action as citizens and be part of a healthy community and create that in our society. So every week on Connect the Dots, I bring you opportunities to do that, and you can also participate in more actions and find out about other things that you can get involved with by signing up at the sign-up post on my website, which is healthjournalistblog.com. You can follow my blogs on the Huffington Post and upcoming on Alternet. And you can also friend me on Facebook on either my personal page, Allison Rose Levy, or at Connecting the Dots for Health. And that's where I list a lot of actions and find a lot of things that you can participate in. And I just want to apologize because this week there are some technical problems in my neighborhood that are making it a little strange, for me this week. So if, you know, I suddenly bop out, I'll come right back in. I hope that doesn't happen because we really have a terrific guest on today's show discussing an issue that we've actually covered three times in the last 2 months, which is our food supply. You know, so often I have written, a lot of people don't know this, but I've written a number of best-selling books as a co-author, collaborative writing partner, and writer with major health leaders like Dr. Joseph Mercola, as well as the people at the Weston A. Price Foundation, Sally Fallon Morrell and Mary Enig, and working with some of the pioneering physicians who have promoted a low-glycemic diet in order to address childhood obesity. So I have quite an extensive background in food and nutrition and, you know, working with health leaders like Andrew Weil and others. And for years, we've been telling people to eat healthy foods. And one of the things that we frequently see, you know, because I have extensive network of people I know throughout the integrative health and environmental communities, one of the things that we often see is people making individual health recommendations, you know, have this organic food, eat that smoothie, eat this, but don't eat that. But it all comes down to, are the healthy foods that we need going to be available? Because if we don't take action on a societal level or on a community level to put them in our schools, to make sure that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which regulates what's grown, promotes healthy foods, if we don't take action on a societal level, the foods that all of the doctors and nutritionists and health experts advise us to eat simply may not be there. They may not be affordable. They may not even be around for reasons that we've discussed in several past programs. And we're going to discuss that again on today's Connect the Dots with someone who is really terrific and has been an amazing bridge person in bringing the truth about what's going on with our global food supply, and particularly America's food supply, to moms and to families, because she herself is a mother and is completely dedicated to her kids, and shows really how that's part that being an activist, which is what she has become in spades, in addition to juggling the tasks of motherhood and being a wife and a family person, with being active on the social level. And she's an incredible role model and bridge person in doing that. So I want to welcome to today's Connect the Dots our guest for today, who is Robin O'Brien. You may have heard of her. She's the author of a terrific book called The Unhealthy Truth, One Mother's Shocking Investigation into the Dangers of America's Food Supply and What Every Family Can Do to Protect Itself. The thing I really love about this book is that it both has deep investigation and science and every single thing that Robin has to say is documented. But unlike the task that so many that we have in journalism, that I've had as a journalist, where, you know, you deliver the objective fact and then you're supposed to leave people with it going, huh, or where you're supposed to sort of, you know, tell the other side, which is, oh, these things are just fine for us. Industry says they're okay, you know. Instead, she really allows herself as a mother, as a feeling person, to respond to this information, which I think is terrific for readers, and why Robin O'Brien serves as such a wonderful bridge for so many people to this information. So it's my pleasure to welcome her today to our show. Welcome, Robin, to Connect the Dots.
Well, thanks so much, Allison. Thank you for your incredible work.
Well, thank you for yours. I just love this book because, you know, I think a lot of people don't face up to some of these things that are going on because there's a sense it's too overwhelming. I just have to handle things in my personal life. Maybe I learn about a few hard facts and I just am so upset by them that I don't want to look at the rest of it. And if I kind of hide in the corner or bury my head in the sand like an ostrich, maybe it'll all just go away, or people tell themselves it couldn't be so bad if it's happening. And what I love, you have such a unique and terrific ability to both give what, as your book title says, the unhealthy truth, but also to share your personal responses. And I think that is so helpful to people, to really know that, you know, we aren't machines. And, you know, hearing that our food supply is so tampered with, I mean, this is a source of our nurturance. An emotional reaction is healthy, and you model that. And I just want to say, I think that along with the wisdom and the deep science and everything else that you have compiled in this book and in your other work, your ability to do that is so helpful to people. So I really want to thank you for that.
Well, you know, I think we all, today the world is incredibly complicated, and there are a lot of shifts that are taking place. And that can be a struggle for all of us. You know, we're dealing with a lot of conditions in the health of our families, in the health of our children. We've got a lot of economic things that are going on. We've got a lot of pressures at home. The divorce rates are really high. I mean, it's a very complicated life that we're leading today. And so when you start to hear some of this information, you just want to throw up your hands and say, I don't want to hear anymore. Don't tell me. Please don't tell me.
Right.
And I was definitely in that space for a very long time. I covered the industry. I covered the food industry as a financial analyst. And so, you know, we'd see these companies come through. We had Costco. We had Walmart. We had Safeway. We had Whole Foods. And when the Whole Foods team would come through our offices, you know, going through their financials, and they would order up a veggie sub for their lunch that day. You know, we just sort of dismissed it as sort of this sort of subset. You know, it's kind of lifestyle of the rich and famous, or maybe it was some hippie
mm-hmm.
thing. You know, and
mm-hmm.
and again, you know, in the worldview that I held at that point, I didn't want to know, and so it was easier to not know. It was easy to shoot the messenger, and that's what I did. And like so many people, you know, it wasn't until the health of my children really started to suffer. And again, because of this financial background, as I started to really look into that, to look into the conditions that were impacting the health of the American children today, I was absolutely stunned. And, you know, it's everything from allergies to asthma to autism to diabetes to pediatric cancer rates that are escalating in our kids. And sadly, it's earned them the title of Generation RX. And you stop right there because you know that our grandmothers weren't dealing with that. You know that our mothers weren't dealing with that. And it just begs the question, what has changed? And I think as I really had to go into that place, you know, I really had to, as I started to really unearth this information and learn this research and learn, you know, what had happened to our food supply, the way the environment is regulated, the way our food system is regulated, and how this generation of children has been called the canaries in the coal mine because they're the first, that their entire world really has just been flooded with these things. There was this period where the heartache was so profound and so real that I really had to pull back. And I can remember one afternoon looking at the four kids out in the backyard and thinking, but you know, I don't want to know this. And it's challenging more than just how I feed my family. This is challenging a belief system. This is challenging a view that I held of our country, of the regulatory agencies. It was challenging so much at that point. And I was so afraid, you know, I was so afraid of confronting it within my own family. I was afraid of confronting it in my social circles. And yet at the same time, what happened in those moments was that I looked out at the kids and I just thought, you know, this love I have for my children is so much more powerful than that fear. And that was when that shift took place. And when I realized that, you know, really this whole mission to protect our families, to protect our health, is so love-inspired. And that's why, you know, I struggle when someone calls me an activist because I don't think it really reflects that love. To me, the title activist sounds like somebody who's angry or mad. And, you know, when you really stop and think about this, you know, this is the work of parents protecting the health of their children. None of us want our kids to have that title, Generation RX. We know that we're buying all these medications for different conditions, you know, today that our grandmothers hadn't even heard of. And I think it's really, you know, giving people permission to say this is a love-inspired thing. And as we learn this information, as the scientific evidence continues to come out, it continues to mount, it gives you permission to say, wow, we didn't know this 5 years ago, we didn't know this 10 years ago, but this is what we know now, and now we're going to act on that. And together we can create this change so that we can have a healthy generation of children, because if you step back from that and you really think about it, the health of our country, the success, the economic prosperity, everything about it is completely dependent on the health of these kids. They're the next generation of leaders.
Yeah, that's really true. And it's also about the health of future generations. You know, so it's about the health of the kids, it's the grandkids, and it's really human life on Earth, plant life on Earth, different species on Earth, a whole range of things that we're doing, the food supply on Earth, you know, because we won't have future generations on Earth unless we think. Carolyn Raffensperger, the ecologist, likes to use the phrase beloved ancestors. Unless we make ourselves, whether you have kids or you don't have kids, you know, whether you have to turn yourself into a beloved ancestor and think not of, you know, a particular narrow corporate bottom line today necessarily or a particular financial bottom line this quarter, but you have to think ahead to future generations. And in that, our children, our grandchildren, they're all holding hands with all the foods and the species, plant and animal, you know, and the breathing organism that is our planet, the living organism that is our planet, that supports life. And so this is really a big responsibility and a choice point for those of us living now.
It's funny because, you know, to hear you talk like that, I can go back to who I was 10 years ago and think, oh my gosh, that's way too big, you know, like there's no way. And yet, as I came into this knowledge, you know, it's like a thread. You start to pull it and you realize how interconnected everything is. And when people first started talking about things like the farm bill, you know, I just thought, oh, it's all for all these people that are out in Berkeley that have this time on their hand to be talking about the farm bill. What does that have to do with me in the grocery store right now, feeding my kids, trying to clean up this mess, you know? And when I really kind of looked into that, because you know, I come from this analytical mindset, It was really, you know, as we kind of started to dig into it, here we had four kids. And as I was trying to do a better job of shuffling some of the, you know, fake processed food out of the diet and replacing it with some of the more real ingredients that my grandmother would have pronounced and recognized, what kept confronting me was the higher price of the real food. Mm-hmm. And that completely annoyed me. I didn't want to deal with it with my husband, didn't want to deal with it with the family budget. And so, you know, of course, analytically, I wanted to understand, why is real food more expensive? And as I really dug into that data, you know, financially, the way that we have structured this is that all the taxpayer resources that we all pay in as a big national family are going towards supporting the growing of these crops that are used for all this fake processed food. Mm-hmm. Meantime, the farmers that are growing things organically, which, you know, by law means without the use of these genetically engineered technologies where they're using gene guns to insert and alter the DNA so that those crops can withstand just high doses and saturations of chemicals and weed killers and pesticides. So the farmers that have chosen to opt out of that system to grow the crops without all of that genetically engineered, high toxic, high chemical agricultural system, those guys are the ones that are charged fees to prove that it's safe. They're charged fees to label it. They don't get marketing assistance programs. They don't get crop insurance programs. So they are completely on their own financially to bring those better products to market. Meantime, all of our taxpayer dollars are supporting the growth of these crops with all these chemicals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I looked at that, I thought, I don't think there's really an American in the country that would choose this. You know, we would all want that cleaner, less chemically intensive food to be more affordable. Mm-hmm. And when I really stepped back and looked at that, I thought, okay, this is a broken system. Mm-hmm. And instead of saying, oh, I feel guilty because I can't afford organic food, you know, really, we've got a fundamental problem at the federal level with the way that we have structured the support, the financial support to our farmers. And once I really started to look at that, you know, I thought, well, how do the farmers feel about it? Because I can make assumptions, but I don't know how the farmers feel about it. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time researching with the farmers, you know, going out to Iowa, going to Kansas, going to these farms, sitting down with these guys who, you know, they wanted to label me an activist, they wanted to not like me at all, and to sit down with them and say, listen, you know, now that we've got this chemically intensive agricultural system with these genetically engineered crops that have been patented by these pesticide and chemical manufacturers, it's changed farming. This is not the farming your grandfather did, is it? And they're saying, no, it's not. My grandfather didn't have to pay licensing fees. My grandfather didn't have to pay royalty fees and trait fees because of this technology that's now inserted into these crops. And, you know, as they really have kind of come forth with a lot of this information, you know, they say, there's all this marketing, there's all this PR, we don't feel that we have a lot of choice. And that has been validated by the Department of Justice. It's also looked into sort of the monopolistic practices that have gone on. And so,
and this,
you know,
is not what people want, because
no,
the,
and I think, you know, what's happened
is that this
is
a growing industry. In fact, the healthy food industry has been a growing industry. So, in fact, it's a, you know, an industry where there's economic benefit because it's growing. However, unfortunately, it's also an economic competitor to entrenched industries, and, you know, which we're unwittingly, all of us, through our tax dollars supporting, and we kind of have to face that hard fact and do something about it, because it's not what people want, and that's reflected. It, you know, what you were saying about a few people in Birkenstocks and Berkeley want their granola, you know, is the original image of healthy food, but it's really, that's 25 years ago, and it's changed a great deal since then. Hey, we're not eating all that much granola necessarily. It's more about, you know, healthy produce and dairy and livestock and all of it, as well as, you know, packaged products and everything. But this is a booming industry because it is what people want. But instead, we are divided. Where it's a divided self. We, you know, those who can afford to sneak around here and buy that, and they do it as a matter of personal choice, and it requires more money, so it automatically marginalizes it as elitist, as you mentioned. But on the other hand, it's really what people are wanting, and we should be supporting that in terms of our tax dollars and our government too.
Well, you know, too, and I think, you know, I think when people are, the house divided cannot stand. We are one national family at this national dinner table, and I think that there has been this polarization with the farmers. And the more time I spend with these farmers, the more I realize that they are our solution, you know, and to really to stand beside them and say, you know, you have every right to have a choice on the farm, because if you don't have a choice on the farm, we're not going to have a choice in the grocery store. And to
realize, why don't they have a choice on the farm, Robin? Tell our listeners that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think a great parallel with this technology that is now being used on the farm, this genetic engineering where they use gene guns to manipulate the DNA so that crops like soy and corn can withstand just high volumes of the chemicals and pesticides and things that are sprayed on the crops. That's a brilliant business model if you step back and think about it, because if I'm the company that's selling all these chemicals, I want to make sure that I can sell as much of them as possible. So if seeds are suddenly engineered to withstand just high toxic doses of those chemicals, that is absolutely great for my bottom line. So they are doing a fantastic job for their shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but what has happened is that that technology is patented, and it's protected under the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office's intellectual property. And just as we've had that very first computer, we just had IBM early days of that technology. It was a giant computer in a giant room, you know. If we had stopped there, we never would have gotten the advances in technology. We wouldn't have lowered the barriers to entry. We wouldn't have brought healthy competition into that space, which would have enabled all of these other, you know, technologies and computer companies and everything else, software, everything that we've got today. That's kind of where we are right now with this genetically engineered technology. We've got this one giant player. And the monopoly that's in place, you know, they license the use of some of their technologies to some of the competitors, for example, like DuPont. But then, you know, like what we've seen recently, when some of those licensed technologies start to actually take hold, DuPont was in development with a product, you know, wasn't even on the market yet. Then, you know, the monopolist can come back in and say, hey, actually, you're out of line here, and $1 billion settlement fee was charged. It was one of the greatest in U.S. court history. And so I think, you know, when you have a monopoly like that, it's not in the best interest of anyone. Really, it's not even in the best interest of the monopolist, because you don't have the best, most efficient, most effective technologies on the market today. And I think, you know, having worked with genetic engineers that are independent scientists, you know, there's such incredible control over the science, over the marketplace, that it's not bringing the best, brightest minds to the table. And I think,
can you explain that a little bit more? You're saying, I just want to be really clear, because this, you know, I read a lot of stuff and talk to a lot of people and drill into a lot of stuff, but your argument there is kind of new to me. So I want to make sure I get it. You're saying the companies themselves, through trying to monopolize for economic reasons, have kind of locked themselves into a narrower science than so that it actually hobbles them. Is that what you're saying there?
You know, I think anytime you see a monopoly, it can cripple an industry, because you don't get collaboration. You don't get innovation and true creativity at the highest level, because what we're seeing, you know, there are scientists out in California, for example, that are saying, you know, we need to kind of bring a lot of this together, bring a lot of this information together so that we can see what's happening, so that we can say, hey, this is what we've got so far, but how do we make it better, you know? And the way to do that is to provide access to that information. But as long as it's protected under these patent laws and this intellectual property, we don't get that. We don't get this open source science. And so, you know, it's very unique. It's a new technology. We don't have a lot of the systems in place of how best to handle it at this point. You know, it is still so extremely new. And so I think that's some of the concern that I'm seeing in the scientific community is, you know, how do we get the best and brightest at the table? How do we get collaboration? Right now the technology, because of this monopoly, it's so, the barriers to entry are so high. The cost of entry is so high. And so if you had a startup, you know, they can't compete with a multi-billion dollar agrochemical corporation. And so we aren't getting that healthy competition in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that is what is so critical for the consumer. It's what's so critical for the farmer. You know, I think the farmers were promised, it's a great example. I mean, they were promised that these genetically engineered seeds were going to reduce their need for all different sorts of inputs that are on the farm. And the argument, therefore, is that, you know, it's going to lower their cost of production. It'll be cheaper to use these genetically engineered seeds because you won't need this, that, and the other. will, you know, as we're starting to hear, and thankfully it's making national news and very mainstream media, these genetically engineered seeds have created sort of this boomerang problem, and that is the weeds that they were designed to try to kind of thwart have basically engineered themselves into what are being called super weeds, and it sort of reads like a sci-fi comic novel or something, you know, but what is happening on these farms is that the weeds have become so powerful and so strong that now the farmers are finding that, you know, not only is it a threat to the crop, but it's a threat even to the machinery and the tools that they're using on the farm. And so now they're having to move to an even higher dose of more toxic weed killers to try to thwart these weeds. But then, you know, interestingly, they're having problems like the tractors are not strong enough. And so they're having to go to, you know, this, like, industrial-grade tractor tire and all, you know, just so
You're
many...
You're saying that these weeds are so powerful that they are defeating the tractor, the metal machinery itself, so that we're actually building powerful super weeds that can't be cut by normal farming equipment?
Exactly.
Amazing.
And, you know, I mean, it really, it does sort of read like a sci-fi thriller sometimes. You know, you really step back and you just think, how have we done this to our food supply? You know, and I think to really alter, to alter things using technology without the long-term studies. You know, there are no long-term studies over the effect of what a genetically engineered seed and these increasing doses of chemicals and toxins are doing to developing babies, you know, in the embryos. I mean, there are no long-term studies. You know, there are no pediatric studies that show, you know, what are the impacts of a generation of children eating a seed that has been genetically engineered to produce and synthesize its own insecticidal toxins.
What about animal studies, Robin? Are there any preliminaries? Because generally, I mean, normally, hopefully, one would hope and expect before unleashing this kind of mass health experiment, there would have been human studies done. But usually the way science works is it goes from animal studies and then, you know, to human studies, if it, you know, before something is done. And, of course, when you don't do the human studies, then there's always deniability. You can say, oh, well, it hasn't been proven. Well,
exactly. So there are no human studies. There was one done on a genetically engineered rice strain, and it was halted because of the ethical concerns of feeding this product to humans. And so we do have some animal studies. But, again, you know, coming from this finance background, it became really clear in working with researchers at Harvard that if industry is funding the study, you know, it's going to tend to favor industry the majority of the time. When you have independently funded studies, it tends to generate a different outcome. We've seen that in the beverage industry. The tobacco industry is another great example of that. And so what's happening is industry is funding the study. In part, again, when you step back and you say, how is our national budget being spent for all of us as a national family? Well, guess what? The FDA doesn't have the money it needs to conduct the independent science to conduct the studies. And so the FDA has to turn to the companies and say, you got to do it for us. We trust you. And what's interesting, because of the patents that are on these foods and the patents that are on these crops, those studies are protected, again, due to the intellectual property. And so we're going on faith with these companies. And they're submitting information, you know, to the FDA, and it does, I mean, it really truly does read like a novel sometimes. But what happens is that the independent studies that do come out tend to directly contradict what the industry is saying. You know, thankfully there's a lot of research coming out of South America right now on this. There's a lot of international research that's coming out. You know, the industry will say, there's no evidence of harm. There's not a single documented case. And without labels here in the United States, they're right, because there's no way to have traceability, accountability, or liability that could prove any evidence of harm if those ingredients were never labeled in the first place. And so it was a brilliant strategy by industry early on to not label these ingredients, because you could never trace it back. And so, therefore, they're able to claim no evidence of harm. But, you know, as you mentioned, that's not exactly the same thing as saying that there is no harm that comes from these products.
Yeah, so it's actually, we last week on the show we had Lisa Stocky from Food Democracy Now, who I'm sure you know quite well, who's been part of the group Food Democracy Now, along with Dave Murphy, mm-hmm. organizing, you know, many thousands, tens and hundreds of thousands of people to support the right to know in the state of California, the right to know if GMOs are in foods via labeling. And so Lisa was with us you know, last week on Connect the Dots, and actually we should probably take our commercial break and talk a little bit about the right to know and why it's so important, just a little recap on that, because we did a whole show on it last week, but I'd love your take on it as well, Robin. So let's
Absolutely.
Take our station break and stay with us, listeners, for a conversation with Robin O'Brien, the author of The Unhealthy Truth, about the dangers of America's food supply and what we can do about it. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. That's Bobby McFerrin singing the garden for us with his group of collaborative musicians in a time when more collaboration and more cultivation of the global garden is the urgent task of the day. I usually give activist actions at the beginning of every show, but as I explained, we were having a few technical difficulties today, so I'm going to give some of them now. First of all, I want to just highlight our terrific guest who I'll be returning to conversation with in just a minute. Her name is Robin O'Brien. She's the author of The Unhealthy Truth, and you can find out more about her terrific ongoing work to raise awareness about the food supply on her website, Robin O'Brien. And Robin is spelled with a Y, so that's R-O-B-Y-N-O-B-R-I-E-N, because O'Brien is sometimes spelled different ways as well. Another action that I want to point listeners toward, if you're in the New York or Northeast region, there's a very important action against fracking, which I've covered a great deal on the program, and there's a key action, as some past listeners may know or it may be new to you, Governor Cuomo is proposing to frack certain regions of New York State for the very first time, bringing the toxic chemicals, radioactivity, and radon to an area upstream from major American cities with millions of people whose food, water, air, and energy sources will be coming potentially more toxic. So you can listen to past shows in the Connect the Dots archives to find out more about that. If it's new to you, if you're familiar with the issue, time to step up and take action. There's a very important rally taking place this coming Monday, August 27th, with an urgent letter from the biologist Sandra Steingraber, who's been a past guest on this program, as well as Gasland film director Josh Fox. And you can find out more information about attending the rally. There'll be buses going from various locations by going to the website www.don'tfrackny.org. And so you can read more about why this is a matter of urgent importance, as well as sign up to take a bus and attend the rally, or to drive if you're more nearby to the Albany area, urging you to do that. We've also been discussing in the show, and we're going to continue with that, the dangers of GMOs. So if you would want to take action about that, you can go to the website CA Right to Know, which is where people from all across the United States can support the state of California in asking for the labeling of GMOs. We'll be talking a little bit more about that as I return to the conversation with Robin O'Brien. So stay listening, folks. And also just want to say, tune into the Connect the Dots archives. If you like this show, forward the link to people, and they can listen in the archives on PRN.FM. And also, if you like this program, please rate us on iTunes. Thank you so much. And now, going back to my conversation with Robin O'Brien. So, Robin, you're just so phenomenally well-informed on this. It's just terrific. We were talking about labeling and why labeling is so important. And I know you've been a little bit out on the stump on this issue because of the concerns that all your terrific analysis and research has uncovered about GMOs, which you explained to our listeners in the first half of the show. Let me ask you a question. From the talks you've given and the people you've talked to and all the traveling you've done, do you think that most people want labeling? Do they want to know whether GMOs are in their food or not? Or do you think they're just kind of happy to be in blissful ignorance? I mean, what's your perception? Because I know you've contacted many, many people, and people also contact you on this issue.
Well, you know, I've had the opportunity to travel the country, speaking to different groups, all profiles, all demographics, all age groups, from farmers to financial executives, to mothers, to, you know, and every end of the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. And there is so much more that unites us than divides us. And I think when you really stop and you consider the fact that 1 in 3 American kids has allergies, ADHD, asthma, or autism, you look at the rates of diabetes, you look at the rates of cancer, the fact that cancer is the leading cause of death by disease in children under the age of 15, there is serious concern. No matter where we are politically, no matter where we are on that socioeconomic ladder, for the health of our children. And that is very unifying, and it is very powerful because it is love-fueled. And when you start there, you realize that that is what is going to create this change. And I think, you know, most Americans, I mean, I was one of them, have no idea that this has even happened. I mean, we had no idea that these things are even in our food. We had no idea that this new technology had been introduced. We had no idea that these crops are basically hardwired to withstand just increasing doses of these chemicals that are being sprayed across them. We had no idea. And so I think, you know, for most Americans, when you have no idea, you don't even know that this is an issue. So you don't even know to care. And I think, you know, when I first came to it, I was like, how did I not know this? You know, have I been living under a rock? Do I feel really stupid because I'm the only American? I mean, do people know about, you know, I felt really ignorant, as if everybody else must already know this and somehow I was late to the party. But the more that I found the courage to actually talk about it, the more I realized that how most of us didn't know. And while other countries around the world had the dialogue, they had the discussion in the media, they had the debate, and they had come to this informed conclusion that the jury is still out on this, there are no long-term human health studies, therefore we want labels. And so countries around the world, you know, the obvious ones, of course, you know, like France and all of Europe and the UK, Australia, New Zealand, but, you know, it's countries like Russia and countries like China that are saying, we're putting labels on these things because we don't know what the long-term effects are. There are no long-term human studies.
I just heard that Turkey is saying, no, you know, we don't want these here. I mean, Turkey is doing it. We think of our country as being the height of civilization, and yet countries that, you know, we don't consider to be as intellectually and scientifically evolved as we are, have identified the concerns that you're speaking of and are taking a protective stance that we haven't taken.
Right. And so, you know, you really step back, and I think, you know, there are obvious concerns over, I mean, there are so many different triggers that will hit people in this discussion. You know, whether you're talking about using these new technologies and this thing called a gene gun to manipulate the DNA so that you can insert these new patented proteins into the seed of corn and into the seed of soy so that, you know, it can either produce its own insecticide or it can withstand increasing doses of weed killer. That's one trigger. That can be one trigger. You know,
to a health issue, you mean?
Well, trigger to somebody that's going to say, I'm gonna exercise precaution. I'm gonna start to make a shift. You know, you know, the other concern really is we don't know what the impact of this increasing saturation of our crops and these chemicals are going to be. And the studies keep coming out highlighting pesticide exposure to things like cancer, to, you know, delayed development of boys, you know, to all kinds of different health concerns, all kinds of different environmental concerns. You know, some people, parents, that's their concern is they just want their kids eating less chemicals, you know? I mean, that's kind of a common sense move. That's something our grandmothers could connect on. You know, for others that don't have kids, they have environmental concerns. You know, what is all of this doing to the quality of the soil that we grow our foods in? We don't know, you know? What are we doing to the quality of the soil, you know, that that all of this this food that we have to use to nourish our bodies and nourish our families, what's it doing there? So there's so many different triggers, but what I'm finding is that once you do sort of pull the curtain and peel it back and you learn this stuff, which is so incredibly hard to hear for those of us that weren't raised this way, I mean, to learn this information and think, what did I eat during those four pregnancies? What did I feed my children? How did I not know what moms in over 40 other countries around the world were told? How did I not know this? Once you move through that and you give yourself permission to say, it's okay. Now I know it now. What am I going to do differently today? I don't want to look back. I don't want to point fingers. I don't want to get into a blame game. I want to look forward, and I want to figure out constructively, what am I going to do to protect the health of my family, myself, and my children going forward? And once you move there, you're okay. But that piece, that place, once people know, then they want to know what they can do to take action. And I think, as I came through it, it challenged more than just how I was going to navigate that grocery store. It challenged relationships. It challenged belief systems. And so I think before you do anything, as you're learning about this information and you want to make a change in your own kitchen with your own family, the absolute most important first thing that you can do is find a friend who is going to stand beside you, kind of shoulder to shoulder, who's going to hold you up when people roll their eyes or maybe your family makes a condescending comment. Because people will. Food is so much more than food. It's so intimate. We use it for so many reasons, culturally, socially. We use it emotionally. There's so many triggers. There's so many things we need it for. And so to have somebody that can be with you, as a friend, cheering you on as you start to make these changes is so incredibly important. Sometimes it's a spouse, sometimes it's a friend, sometimes it is a family member, but have that person there beside you. And
I
then
just want to interject something here, Robin, because this is really interesting to me, because this is one of the reasons that, in describing you at the very beginning of the show, I said that you were an amazing bridge. And I think this, what you're saying now really demonstrates that. I hate to kind of cut you off, but I just want to acknowledge, right now, we're on the Progressive Radio Network. Of course, everyone all across the United States is welcome and invited to listen. This is built on the work of Gary Null, who is a longtime health journalist for 3+ more decades, investigative journalist, really willing and ready and able to drill deep into a lot of things that are considered acceptable in our society that have health impact that hasn't really been fully assessed. And he's been a real pioneer in doing that, and he founded this network a number of years back. So this network has a very strong pro-health audience and also a progressive audience. But I really want to take the hat off to you and salute you, because what you're describing is a lot of people that are not coming from the mindset that I think most listeners to this program, although everybody is welcome, but most of the likely listeners would fall into a slightly different pool. So I just want to kind of tackle that directly, because you are talking to the people and know the people, and in some case maybe even come from the people who, roll their eyes, don't want to hear about it, think you're, kind of off base if you bring this kind of thing up. And one of the things that we have going on right now is a tremendous divide in our country, between groups of people who see reality, in very different and mutually exclusive ways. So as someone who is a bridge, and I know we are here to talk about the food supply and those issues, and that's our usual that's your usual topic that you're incredibly well versed in, I hope you don't mind my taking this opportunity to just ask you to talk a little bit about that, because you are a bridge in both worlds. And I think, coming from the progressive view, a lot of people don't have the access that you do. They, to people who think differently all across the board, they're in despair about, the kind of brainwashing or shutdown or different perspectives in a mass of the population that is kind of ignoring these things or doesn't get it. And I just would love to get your perspective on that. not only in relation to this issue, very important issue, but just in general, because I think people are really in perplexity about what folks, the ones who are rolling their eyes, like what they're thinking, how they're feeling, what any insights that you could share with our listeners about that, if you don't mind, would be so valued. Because
I really had to go back into my own response, you know, when people tried to tell me this 5 or 10 years ago, and the defense mechanisms that were up, the fear I had, the fear of change, the fear of the challenge that it created to my belief system, which then would challenge, you know, an upbringing and the way I was raised. I mean, it was...
What were your belief system?
It was that big, you know. It's the notion that you are really questioning an authoritative agency, you know, and to really step back and say, you know, financially, is this system structured for the benefit of the consumer or for the benefit of the corporation? And you know, I think now, you know, especially in this election year, we're realizing how much money there is in politics, regardless of which side of the aisle anyone is on.
Mm-hmm.
And to really say, you know, it's up to me to protect the health of my family. Because these corporations, their absolute fiduciary duty, their first responsibility by law is to their shareholders, not to their customers, not to the consumer, not to the farmers. It's to their shareholders. And so they've got to drive profitability. And the best way that they can do that is by delivering products, but also by making sure that there's a regulatory environment that's favorable for them, and that, you know, they've got a political environment that's favorable to them. And so, you know, we're starting to see, we see so many influences by industry, you know, on both sides of the aisle in Washington, D.C. And so that's what we've got. That's the system we've got in place today. It's been built up over the last several decades. But what can I do, you know, here in my own town, in my own community, in my own city, in my own home, at my own school, with my friends and family? What can I do? And I think one of the first things you've got to do is you've got to listen. And I think, you know, all too often you get information like this, whether you're talking about fracking or whether you're talking about the food supply, whether you're talking about the changes in the environment and the weather and the climate. And when you learn the information, it can be so life-changing, and you sort of want to grab people by the shoulders and say, you've got to listen, you've got to pay attention. And I think that shuts people down. I think the very first thing, no matter how much you want to share that information out, you first got to listen. You've got to be receptive to where they are. You've got to hear where their concerns are. And again, the unifier is the health of our families. We've got this unifying, profound concern over what is happening to the health of our families. The American Cancer Society says 1 in 2 men and 1 in 3 women are expected to get cancer in their lifetime. There's not anyone in the country who hasn't been touched by it through a friend or a family member, you know, that has had to battle cancer. And so to really go there, to go to that unified place where you stand on common ground first, what are your concerns? What are you the most worried about? Is it the rising cost of food prices? Is it the rising cost of medical care? You know, I mean, right now there are polls being taken of mothers around the country, and the primary concern are the rising prices of food. So then to come in and say you got to buy organic, I mean, she's not going to want to hear that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to want to say, you know, I totally get the high prices of food, and I know that I'm worried about the health of my kids, and I feel guilty, and there's angst, and there's all of this emotion that's part of it. And to really acknowledge that and validate that first before you even try to teach, I think is incredibly important. And I think, too, it's really just this compassion for the fact that we're all learning this. Some people have known it for a long time. Others are learning it for the first time, and to really have compassion the way you would for a kid that's learning how to ride his bike, you know, that they're going to fall off, they're going to need help, they're going to need support. To really have that kind of compassion and kindness as you lead, I think is incredibly important.
Wonderful insights, you know, thank you. I think also what happens a lot, you know, is that people who are, you know, in the direct front line of affliction, and recognize they are, like if
somebody lost their water supply, as has happened in areas of Pennsylvania due to fracking. That's pretty obvious. So there can be people who are directly at the front lines, and they know there are. There can be people who are at the front lines, their child has been chemically injured, and they don't know they are. There are people who may have, you know, be further back at a degree where, as far as they know, they haven't yet to be affected because they didn't know that dad's cancer had any component of toxic exposure as a causative factor. They don't have that information. So people also stand, and then there may be those who are working for or invested in industries that are profiting from these things. So we all do stand in different places in relation to these issues. And the sense is, you know, to kind of barricade oneself where one is. And I think also there has to be compassion. You know, there's a fear of not being polite, of people getting angry. It turns people off. You know, when people are on the front lines and they don't have water, their children are injured and they understand the reason, you know, they're not going to be happy campers about it always. They're going to be upset. They're going to be a little angrier. So when they're further away, then they may not so much want to know about it, you know. So I think I agree with you. I think it helps to acknowledge that we all stand in different places and to have compassion across the board, because what looks like ignorance or denial could be fear.
I think in most cases it is fear. And I think, you know, fear protects the ego. Fear shields the heart. And, you know, maybe it's because I'm a mother of four and I have complete sensitivity for seeing that in a child who's trying something for the first time. It's mm-hmm. almost like you've got to remember that. You know, you've got to remember the forgiveness and the kindness and the compassion that you would use with a child who was afraid of something for the first time. As silly as it might sound, or as, you know, nonsensical as it might sound, you know, it's you just go there to that vulnerability. And I think to really offer that out first before the mm-hmm. information, before anything else, is probably the greatest gift you can give to those that you really care about, because it is hard. I mean, you learn this information and you understand how hard it is to hear, and yet at the same time, for the people that you love and the people that you care about, you know, you want to protect them from harm. You want to try to help them exercise prevention. And so there is an urgency to it that's very real. And I think to balance all of that is really the task.
I agree with you. I think this is a really great conversation. And it's also true that what sounds like anger or appears as angry people protesting or complaining about something, that there may be a sense of, I want to distance myself from that, or why are they so angry? You know, I would suggest that they're angry because they are hurt, because they have been injured. They're near the front lines, and it brings us back to the essence of who we are as people and what we are as a society. In other words, do we care for the people who were hurt? So who lost this, whose children were harmed? We may not be there yet. That's why we have the expression canary in the coal mine. They're shouting the loudest, not because they're annoying, irritating, weird people, but because they have suffered something. And who are we as people and as a nation? Do we care? Like, if a child fell down and scraped their knee and was crying and screaming and was hurt, do we turn their back on them because we don't like to hear that reaction? No. So, I mean, I think it goes all across the spectrum. I think this is really a very useful conversation that we need to have more and more on a national level about how to bridge our differences. And I just want to thank you so much, Robin, for everything that you bring, this conversation, your wisdom. I want to point people again to your website, Robin with a Y, O'Brien with an E, .com, and your book, The Unhealthy Truth. And just thank you so much for being on Connect the Dots. I want to urge listeners who've enjoyed this, share this with your friends. You can find the show in archives in a couple of days, and within 48 hours it'll be there. Go to Robin's website, see what her current activities are. Robin, I'd love to, I hope we get chances to continue this. I think it's a really important conversation for the healing of our country and of the earth and making a better world for our children. And actually, I just got a note from our wonderful engineer, Matt Bogart, that the archives will be up right after the show. So you can let people know if you've enjoyed this program with Robin O'Brien, listeners, as well as rating us on iTunes. I think this has been a terrific show. Robin, thank you so much for being on Connect the Dots, and I look forward to more conversations with you about this. I think it's really a very important thing you're doing, and thank you so much for your work.
Thank you, too, Allison.
Come back next week, listeners, for Connect the Dots, Wednesday at 10 a.m., every week, Eastern Time, on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.